Live today from back here in the WWDB studios, it's The Other Animals for Friday, September 11th. I'm Laurent Levy. Thanks for checking us out today. Hope everyone had a great Labor Day weekend. And yeah, it's September 11th. Admittedly disconcerting to be doing anything or thinking about anything other than that date. You know, as the date approaches each year, it kind of looms, doesn't it? If you're scheduling appointments, or in my case, interviews, and you pencil in or try to schedule on your e-tool 9/11, you get a queasy sensation. It's almost like guilt, as though it's irreverent or even rude to be doing so. Can you believe it's already the 19th year? And talk about unsettling. For most of this year's incoming college freshman class, they would be the first such group to be born after that day. What an odd twist of fate for them that they would be contending with their own crisis and not being able to actually go to school, at least not in the traditional sense. And it surely can't go without saying that in many ways, their COVID crisis dwarfs 9/11 in scope. Essentially, a 9/11 every day in terms of the number of deaths, at least here in the U.S. But I was thinking about this last night. See, I'm the accompanist for Lashier. It's a small but tenacious choir based out of Princeton. And while we haven't been able to rehearse since last March, we periodically get together via Zoom to at least stay in touch. Last night was one such meeting, and it was filled with stories of coping, adapting, and resilience. How members have been able to see grandchildren and care for elderly parents, even if mostly virtually. How they've managed to adjust their work, their inability to travel, deal with the weird perception in tracking the days of the week. And in this odd capability to adapt more or less successfully to work with, or in some cases, around what we're given, I had an odd epiphany of a sense of communion with the other animals who do the exact same thing all the time. I mean, think about an example. A completely unnatural and potentially harmful impact back in the day, back even before my time, that electrification should have had on wildlife. Telephone poles and wires were none were before, or as Robert Frost put it, they planted dead trees for living. What a potential catastrophe for the animals that depend on those living trees. And yet, birds on the telephone wire seem as natural now as does the inexplicable abundance of wildlife around Chernobyl. Maybe that's a topic for another day. But yeah, we're going to get through COVID, just like we did 9/11. And it's our resilience and ability to adapt is definitely one of the more positive traits we share with the other animals. All right, we have a fun show for you today. Have you ever had a conversation with someone that's just so interesting that for each subject you raise, it seems to open up three more? And before you know it, hours have slipped by. Well, my conversation with Corey Wren, who researches and writes about some of the weirdest and least understood aspects of the animals' rights movements, was just such a conversation. So much so that I'm telling you right now, I couldn't fit it all in one show, and we're going to be spreading it out. But really, listen to some of the unique areas she writes about. Atheism in the animal rights movement, free riders in nonprofits, exploiting disabilities in animal rights activists, and wait for it, Trump veganism. Yeah, our conversation today gets us going by looking at why there seem to be so many animal rights organizations at all and how they distinguish themselves and have some of them become victims of their own success. We're also going to hear from our friend Paul Shapiro about a new clean meat startup that is working exclusively on viable pet food options. And a bit later, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls will take a look at what to do if your pet is limping. But first, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, since we're feeling kind of hopeful today, I thought I might take talk a bit about some research that was published this week in the journal Nature Sustainability. And it takes a look at fungus-derived renewable leather substitutes. In other words, growing leather from, ready for this, mushrooms instead of cows. Fungus-derived leather technologies were first patented by U.S. companies MycoWorks and Ecovative Design about 5 years ago. These technologies take advantage of the root-like structure of mushrooms called, I'm going to mispronounce this, mycelium, which contains the same polymer found in crab shells. When mushroom roots are grown on sawdust or agricultural waste, they form a thick mat that can then be treated to resemble leather. Because it's the roots and not the mushrooms being used, This natural biological process can be carried out anywhere. It does not require light. It converts waste into useful material and stores carbon blended in the growing fungus. Going from a single spore to a finished fungi leather or mycelium leather product takes about a couple weeks compared with years required to raise a cow to maturity. Mild acids, alcohols, and dyes are typically used to modify the fungal material, which is then compressed, dried, and embossed. The process is quite simple and can be completed with minimal equipment and resources by artisans. It can also be industrially scaled for mass production. The final product looks and feels like animal leather and has similar durability. Commercial products made with fungi-derived leather are expected to be on sale soon, so the real question is whether it will cost you an arm and a leg. Prototypes were released last year in the U.S., Italy, and Indonesia in products including watches, purses, bags, and shoes. And while these fundraiser items were a little pricey, with one designer bag selling for about $500, manufacturing cost estimates indicate the material could become economically competitive with traditional leather once manufactured on a larger scale. So we're going to have this, you're going to hear this in a second here, we have this common theme here that when we have these startups, these prototypes are, the price point is the issue. And, you know, can it be economically viable? We're always going to be balancing that cost versus what, you know, the potential environmental and ecological benefit. And it does come to that, you know, there's a reality that I don't think we ever want to get to a point, I don't think we ever can get to a point where that we don't have that. You know, there's always going to be this sense of it might be nice, it might be great, but if I can't afford it, it's theoretical. All right. So we're going to see that, and we're going to continue to see that. So speaking of natural-based startups, I want you to listen now to my conversation we had yesterday with Paul Shapiro about another startup that's dealing with slaughter-free meats for dogs and cats.
All right. By now, you may have heard that we mentioned the story, I believe, a week ago of Bond Pet Foods, a company that has developed the world's first animal-free chicken protein for dog and cat nutrition. So to find out more about this, we're call on here our resident expert on clean meat. That's Paul Shapiro. He's joining us again. As you may recall, he's the author of Washington Post bestseller, Clean Meat, How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. He's also the co-host of the Business for Good podcast. He's a four-time TEDx speaker. He's got over 20 years of experience as a nonprofit executive and has published more than 100 articles on food sustainability, from daily newspapers to academic journals. Paul, welcome back to the show.
I'm very honored to be called a clean meat resident expert. What a pleasure.
You're the man. You're the man. All right. So tell us about this product. What is this all about? We've got a company that is it a venture company, and they're making a meat-free clean meat product?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really call it meat-free. It is real chicken protein, but it's a very interesting thing because the last time we talked, we chatted about companies that would take, for example, a small biopsy from a chicken. And inside of that biopsy, there are millions of little cells that you can grow into actual chicken meat. So you can grow chicken meat outside of the chicken's body. In this case, a Colorado startup called Bond Pet Foods, and yes, they are venture-backed. They are backed by I think their leading VC is called Lever Ventures. So they're a food tech venture company where they just focus on interesting food tech companies. But anyway, point is that Bond has taken a different approach, that rather than using a starter cell from an actual chicken, they have gone through microbial fermentation to produce real chicken proteins. And so
microbial,
let me give you a little bit of
Okay, yeah, that sounds good.
Yes. Okay, so microbial fermentation is what we use to make bread and cheese and wine and beer. But they've done something pretty interesting. So let's just back up. So, you know, a little very basic science. If you take brewer's yeast, you feed it sugar, you get alcohol. That's what it produces. That's how you make beer or wine. You take brewer's yeast. Okay. If you take a different type of yeast called baker's yeast, feed it sugar, you get CO2, and it helps your bread to leaven. That's how you get bread to leaven with baker's yeast. Okay. And so what Bond has done, though, is taken a special type of yeast And when you feed it sugar, instead of producing alcohol or instead of producing CO2, it produces real chicken proteins. And I don't mean proteins that are comparable to chicken proteins. I don't mean proteins that function like them. I mean, under a microscope, they are chicken protein. And it's really remarkable. And so this is like what was done, for example, as well for insulin for diabetics. So for decades, the only way that diabetics had to get insulin was, you know, you took cattle and pig pancreases and crushed them to get the insulin out of them. And then that was shipped all over the country for diabetics. But in 1990, it was discovered by Eli Lilly, or excuse me, Eli Lilly was a major user of those pancreases. However, Genentech, which is a biotech company, figured out how to take microbes and get them to produce human insulin, not something that's like human insulin, but actual human insulin. And now diabetics inject themselves with actual human insulin that doesn't have to be harvested from human bodies, but that's just produced from microbes. And that's what Bond has done here. They have taken microbes and gotten them to produce actual chicken proteins and put it into bars for dogs. Now, they're not selling them yet, but because I did write the book Queen Meat, that they were interested in having my review of it. And my friends at Bond Pet Foods were very kind, and they sent me one of the bars with the chicken protein that they had grown. And I fed it to my dog, Eddie, who is a very finicky eater. He's a pit bull and he's very cute, but he does not like all foods. And I put up a video online on social media, including on Eddie's account, which is on Instagram. If you want to view it, it's just Eddie the Pitty. So E-D-D-I-E the Pitty, P-I-T-T-I-E. So Eddie the Pitty on Instagram. You can see the video of Eddie eating this real chicken protein bar that Bond Pet Foods grew. And it's really exciting. And he loved it. He ate it. He wanted more. I gave him more and he really enjoyed it.
So it passed the Eddie taste test. So that's always a good first hurdle. So make sure you understand. So there is an extract from a blood draw, I guess, from a chicken to get this thing started. But other than that, that's the end. That's the end of actual a live animal involvement. You know, and once they're able to draw, you know, and that chicken is doing his normal chicken stuff right now, or but once that initial draw is done, that's it. They can begin to draw to grow the culture, one and done from that point. Is that right?
No. So what you're describing is the conventional way that startups in the space are growing chicken meat, but what Bond Pet Foods has done, they don't even need the starter chicken at all. Oh. They simply have persuaded this microbe to produce chicken protein.
Well, where do they
in
get
the same way
from?
That
what's
yeah, I mean they may have the initial way to program these microbes is, you know, I'm actually not sure if they had to actually use any type of probably it's like the type of thing that you can order and then program into the yeast. I'm not really sure. I'd like to find that out.
Okay.
But there's no biopsy that is coming from a chicken and that's creating a cell culture in that type of a way.
All right. So the Bond is a startup. So they've not been in. It's not like they've been in the traditional pet food market at all. Right. They're starting up completely just for this, focusing on this niche that they hope to be successful at, which is, I guess, clean. What would we call it? Clean pet food. Right. So that's who they are. Right. They've not been to market with another product, with a traditional product yet.
They are a startup. They do have a traditional product, but it's very limited. They do offer a bar, but it is a yeast-based bar, but it doesn't contain chicken protein in it. So okay. I've also fed those to Eddie. He enjoyed those too. So you can buy that from their website if you're interested, but it does not contain this historic chicken protein in it.
Okay. So since it actually is, it's producing actual chicken protein, the nutritional aspects for your dog and cat should be sound. And I'm leaning, because we talked last time and we've actually talked a couple times since then, nutrition wise on these products, there's more wiggle room for dogs than there is for cats, in that cats have to have this lutein in there. They are obligate carnivores, but it sounds like this product answers that. If the product that's being produced is actual chicken protein, then in in theory, that lutein and those nutrients that the cat needs are in there?
So just to be clear, what you're referring to as lutein is actually taurine is what you're referring to. Lutein is found widely in leafy green vegetables and so on. But what you're referring to is a particular amino acid called taurine, which cats do have to have. And right. So there are synthetic taurines out there, though. Like you can, you know, so theoretically you could just, fortify. Thank you.
Okay.
Theoretically, you can just fortify cat food with the synthetic taurine. So you don't really, you know, it's not addressing that. But yes, this is the general point that you're making, though, is absolutely correct, which is that this is real chicken protein. And so it has all those same benefits for animals like cats who, obviously evolved to consume meat. Mm-hmm. And so it enables them a way to have that actual animal protein without having to raise and slaughter animals in the first place. And that's beneficial not only for the chicken, which is very important because there's a lot of animal welfare concerns with chicken production, but it's also important because raising animals for food just takes up a lot of land, takes up a lot of water, a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, antibiotic resistance concerns, mm-hmm. pandemic amplification concerns. Mm-hmm. The list goes on and on as to why we would want to find sustainable alternatives to raising animals for food. Mm-hmm. And if we are able to produce the same proteins without having to raise and slaughter animals, but to do it through microbial fermentation, it would enable a much more sustainable, much more humane supply chain.
I mean, it's definitely win-win. There's no question about it. Everybody wins all the way across the environment, the quote unquote livestock, and the pets themselves, I would think. Now, but on that topic, so we have a startup, we have a venture funding. What is their sense of a price point here? When it comes to market, is it going to be competitive? Is it going to be more expensive than traditional pet food, or do they have a sense of that yet?
Yeah, I don't want to speak for them, but I will say that, of course, it will definitely be more expensive at first. Mm-hmm. Right now, these type of technologies have usually been in the realm of biotech for medical purposes, like biomedicine, and like for insulin, like what we were talking about. And so people are generally willing to pay a lot for medicine, but people are not willing to pay a lot for food. Mm-hmm. And they're especially not willing to pay a lot for pet food. Now, of course, there is a trend in pet food where people are starting to pay more for human grade meat and so on. But overall, generally speaking, pet food is still very inexpensive.
Yeah. I was wondering that this particular company, that Bond, is focusing on that for those reasons, because typically, and tell me if I'm wrong, pet food, dog and cat food is generally, it's a byproduct, right? In other words, they don't slaughter cows or go fishing for salmon just for dogs and cats. Dogs and cats are getting what's left over, right? They're getting the byproducts of the slaughter process, and that's why dog and cat food is relatively cheap. So it seems counterintuitive that a company would go for that, would start with the pet food as opposed to going into the broader market.
Well, increasingly a large portion of the pet food market is human grade meat, and more and more people are looking to spend more and more money on their pets. And so it's definitely true. Like, you know, when you start looking at the lowest end of pet food products, a lot of the time it is byproducts or types of parts of the animal that were rendered unfit for human consumption and so on. But even those products do still have an environmental toll, because they basically make it cheaper to raise the animals because there's a use for those products. So there is that, but I agree with your general point, which is that often in the pet food world, you're going after the lowest cost products. I'd imagine in this case, again, I don't want to speak for Bond Pet Foods, but I would imagine that in this case, that they would be going after that higher end pet food consumer who is already accustomed to spending, on things like grass fed products or organic products for their pets.
Do you see, just in a couple minutes left here, do you see, are they the only, is Bond the only one in town, or is everyone else kind of waiting to see how they do before they've got a competitor that's jumping into the fray here?
They're definitely not the only one. So if you look at other startups in the space, for example, there's one that is called Because Animals, And Because Animals is another cool startup that's also racing to try to produce actual meat that they are growing with instead of raising and slaughter animals to sell. And so they are doing some cool things. There's another company, another startup called Wild Earth that I don't know if they are still planning on doing this, but they were originally looking at like culturing mouse protein for cats. Yes, because think about how many mice cats eat, a very large amount. Outdoor cats are feasting on mice and rats all the time. They're actually, outdoor cats.
Outdoor cats. I could see that could be sort of a, one of the nice things about having cats is they keep your rodents at bay if you're an indoor cat.
It's a nice thing if you're not a rodent, but yes. But anyway, so yeah, look, the race is on to produce and commercialize the first slaughter-free real meat products. We already know about the race to sell products that look and taste like animal meat. Companies like Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods have done a really great job of advancing the plant-based meat world. But there's another whole cadre of startups, dozens and dozens of them now, that have all been founded within the last few years, racing to commercialize the world's first actual animal meats that were produced without having to raise and slaughter animals. And I believe that these startups in the future are going to lead us to a time when we're going to look back and we're going to think, I'm so grateful that we no longer have to factory farm and slaughter all those billions and billions of animals. That what a relief that we no longer have to do that in order to produce animal meat for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And we're going to think that these startups, like the ones that we've been talking about today, were some of the real pioneers who helped to chart a better, more sustainable food future for humanity.
Well, we can only hope. I hope you're right. I think you will be. You're all right too. So let's stay at it, right? All right. Hey, that's there you go. That's Paul Shapiro, author of Clean Meat: How Growing Meat Without Animals Will Revolutionize Dinner and the World. So once again, give me that Instagram site for Eddie.
Yeah, so my wife runs the account, so she'll be especially pleased for people to go look at this. So Eddie is at Eddie the Pity. So EddieThePittie. And if you go to his Instagram account, you will see a video of Eddie, who is an extremely cute dog, eating one of the world's first ever bars containing real clean chicken protein cultivated from microbes rather than from slaughter.
Very cool. All right. Hope you go check that out. That's Paul Shapiro. Hey, thanks a lot, Paul. We'll stay in touch.
My pleasure.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting listening to that again. There's we do have a theme today, right? The end is optimistic, hopeful. He feels grateful for the pioneers in the field, and I do think he's right. I think that is where we're going, and there is this sense of not just getting through, but understanding, learning from the mistakes of what we're doing, of what we have done, and applying them and getting to a better place. So we're going to definitely stay in touch with Paul and follow that story through. All right, when we're going to take a quick break, when we come back, you're going to hear my conversation with Corey Wren, and you're not going to want to miss that. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Olivia Munn with my shelter pets, Frankie and Chance. Say hi, guys. When I adopted them, I discovered that they both have incredible personalities. Chance's sole purpose in life is to love and to be loved. Frankie is a little bit of a scoundrel and always entertaining. They're a little bit of a lot of things, but they're all pure love. Adopt pure love at theshelterpetproject.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council, the Humane Society of the United States, and Maddie's Fund.
All right, why can't we be friends indeed? Welcome back to the Other Animals here on WWDB. And when it comes to the animal rights movement, it seems like growth can be a mixed blessing as organizations become larger. They often compromise the very principles they hold so dear when they were just getting started. Or so says scholar Corey Wren. This is really, my conversation here is very far-reaching, and it's a, this is just the first segment where we're going to sort of get into all the organizations, sort of what their history is, and this peculiar issue of what happens when they become large, and what is compromised, and how do the larger organizations, once they get there, how do they relate to the smaller organizations, and can they all be friends? So here now is the first part of my conversation with Corey Wren.
Corey Wren is lecturer of sociology with the School of Social Policy, Sociology, and Social Research at the University of Kent, and co-director of the Center for the Study of Social and Political Movements. She received her PhD in sociology from Colorado State University in 2016. In addition to co-founding the International Association of Vegan Sociologists, she founded the Vegan Feminist Network, an academic activist project engaging intersectional social justice praxis. She's the author of A Rational Approach to Animal Rights, Extensions in Abolitionist Theory, Piecemeal Protest, Animal Rights in the Age of, and Animals in Irish Society. When it comes to the animal rights movement, her research is quite simply vast. Some of the topics she's written about includes medical framing of activists, free riders within the movement, and Trump veganism, which I hope we can get to today. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I'm really excited about this. Yeah. So it's really quite, your research is so vast and creative. I'd say I'm enamored by your work. Can you just love how you got into the field? What was your initial foray into it?
Oh, geez. Well, first off, thanks for calling it vast. That boosts my self-esteem a little bit, because when you do animal stuff in sociology, you're the animal sociologist, and you do get pigeonholed is a bad word to use for, but that's what it is.
Oh, no, it's perfect.
The story I always give is that when I was in graduate school, I went to Colorado State to specifically chose their program because it was a green program, very environmentally focused. And I thought, okay, this is a place where maybe I can, at the time I was already doing environmental justice research, but I realized quite quickly that there was a lot of discrimination, I think, against animal studies in green sociology, and people didn't really take it seriously, and I'll get smart remarks from professors and,
really?
And students. And I just decided that it'd be an act of protest.
All right, so here's what I'm hoping to do today. I've had on the program over the last year and a half or so, probably about a dozen or so leaders. I won't even say representatives from various animal rights organizations, and I've struggled as I've interviewed these people just to sort of get a sense of where their organizations sit, what distinguishes them from each other. So I was wondering if you could, for our listeners, because I've fumbled and bumbled around with it, if you could give us a sense of the history, a brief history of the animal rights movement, but particularly this distinction, I think, between animal welfare, organizations that focus on animal welfare, and organizations that focus on animal abolition. Or liberation, whichever you want to call it.
Okay. Well, I will premise this by saying that what I'm about to say is quite typical of other social movements. The issue is that the animal rights movement, because it is stigmatized as about animals, it's not taken as seriously in social justice spaces or in social movement studies. But the pattern that we're seeing in the animal rights movement is what we see in other movements, to the point where we can predict this of movements. So basically what happened was, you know, in the 1800s, the movement kind of began, it established itself, it kind of got stagnant, went into abeyance during the World Wars. There were more things that more important things people felt they need to prioritize. There was a major social shift. And then, you know, in the 1960s, when lots of different movements started to kind of regroup and reemerge, and there was definitely the spirit of grassroots community-based agitation. But what generally happens with these movements is that can be quite costly or quite expensive as far as time, resources, and risk. And you have a lot of people who start to see how much nicer it might be if we had regularized this or bureaucratized this, turn this into something that's more 9 to 5 and a little bit easier to handle. I don't have to risk losing my job. In fact, I can make this my job. And we don't have to worry about police repression and all that sort of stuff. So you start to see in the 1970s, social movements start to get swept into that, where they start to make this decision to professionalize. And a lot of this is built on the also concurrently rise of neoliberalist thought, where this idea of the more rational we are, the more efficient we are, the more growth-oriented we are, the more effective we can be. So that kind of free market mentality started to impact social movements as well. So this rationalization process, this professionalization process, so it's happening across the board with other social movements. Now, what happens is you make that decision, there's consequences that come with that. So you can imagine if one of the gains of reducing risk is, well, you need a little bit of risk in order to shake the system. Mm-hmm. And when you avoid police repression, you do need to be able to piss off the police a little bit, because then you're not really doing your job. You're now becoming transparent to the state. You're cooperating with officials. You're cooperating with the targets of your protests. And so you definitely moderate considerably. Mm-hmm. So that's a consequence that some activists would see as problematic. So back to the animal rights movement in particular, they actually did not really move into that professionalization until the late 80s, early 90s. And then by 2000, it had pretty much professionalized. But you start to see in the mid 90s, cracks starting to form, where there are groups of activists who are really worried about the consequences about professionalizing and becoming part of the system rather than apart from the system. So that's when you see the abolitionist faction emerging with the work of Tom Reagan. You start to see direct action folks. The ALF, of course, have been active from the 1970s, but in the 1980s and 90s, you start to see them really come into their own and become
I just want to, ALF is the Animal Liberation Front, right? And and those are the guys that that actually have direct action that go into labs and just so our listeners know, these are the ones that were targeted as terrorists, I don't want to do a sidebar on ALF, but those are the ones that
this is all relevant because at the beginning, like PETA, for instance, was a major supporter of the ALF and would print a lot of their stuff. Compassion Over Killing, which is one of the most moderate groups now, it's based in DC. They started out as a very radical student group where you look at their early newsletters and it looks like the ALF on the front of their stuff. So
but they changed their name though, right? They just went through a name change to Animal Outlook.
Oh, that's them. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, this is all part of their kind of corporate kind of brand making stuff, because they want to be seen as this moderate, everyone can kind of participate and be a part of this sort of thing, and it loses its radical edge. But folks should know that this is one of the most radical groups. If you go back and look at their early newsletters, it's a completely different organization. Wow. So yeah, in the 1990s, this is when it was really a really contentious era in the animal rights movement, the second wave of the animal rights movement. And also in the mid 1990s is when the start of the no-kill movement began. So now we credit that with Nathan Winograd, but way back in the 1990s, we had the first no-kill conference that had been formed. And that also was a response to the kind of the moderation of the animal rights movement, where euthanasia became something that was just standard rather than something that was critiqued. And so the no-kill movement emerged as a way of, you know, challenging that bureaucratization of killing. Uh-huh. And for folks who don't know, like back in the day, like the first wave of the animal rights movement, the SPCA in Britain, and also in the U.S., they actually were formed and as a way to deal with dogs and cats that were in urban areas. And what happened was the respective governments said, okay, we don't have the resources to deal with this. We'll let you deal with it. So that does two things. That releases their burden from having to pay for this dealing with the urban cat and dog problem. I put that in quotation marks. Uh-huh. But it also has the more insidious effect of putting that burden on the folks, the activists. They're now doing the killing. So now they've reduced the threat of protest, reduced the threat of critique from the public by putting that onto that, shifting that burden. The nonprofit sector is something like, I think it's like the third largest sector in the world, economy rather. I mean, it's big business. And one of the consequences you see is when these organizations become a professional nonprofit, their wealth explodes. So it's, again, it's this kind of economic logic of growth. If we play by these rules, if we play by capitalism's rules and we can amass all this growth, then perhaps we'll be more effective. But it's kind of a catch-22, because once you get to that state, you actually have to become more risk-averse because you have more at stake. And this is one of the, you mentioned at the beginning, like they all, like what's the difference? What they all seem the same. And one of the consequences of this, social movement scholars, but also just one of the, one of our founding sociological theorists, Max Weber, observed this, where you have a, one of the consequences is what we call isomorphism, which is a fancy way of saying that these organizations, as they rationalize in order to reduce risk, because that's one way of becoming more rational, and we'll just do what everybody else is doing. We know that works for this other organization. So for instance, us see like with PETA and with the HSUS, Humane Society of the United States, you see other smaller organizations that are hoping and aspiring to become larger and more powerful and more wealthy. They start to take on the same tactics and the same sort of hierarchical structure, mimicking these larger organizations. And then, of course, once they become charities, they take on the same. I mean, and you also see leaders being swapped in and out where I can't even keep up with them anymore. I think that would make an interesting research project, how much incest there is between these different organizations. So, yeah, they actually become very similar to one another. And then when they go to like compete for grants and funding, which is the bulk of where they get their research, their funding from, is from these grants from foundations. Then, of course, they'll kind of make a little spin and say, oh, this is a slightly different thing that we do. Like with vegan outreach, we go out and flyer on campuses. But it's all pretty much the same thing. These organizations are doing the same sort of tactics, just maybe slightly different for grants.
So there, I mean, your sense is there's a lot. There is lots of overlap, right, between what they're doing. So if you had to, can you give us sort of a better definition of what an abolitionist-oriented organization might be versus a welfarist-oriented organization?
Okay. Well, you nailed it on the head when you said people have had trouble or had different – it's difficult to define, because this is the thing. I have in my second book, Piecemeal Protests, Animal Rights in the Age of Nonprofits, which is what we're talking about now. If you want to learn more, that book has got a big survey of the movement. But one of the chapters in there is called We're All Abolitionists. So when I looked at a content analysis of all these different organizations after the abolitionists had really started to make a stir in the mid-1990s, and then of course in the 2000s, they really started going hard, you start to see that the nonprofits, first off, many of them won't respond to that. It's not in their interest to respond to that. It's much easier. It's a bigger flex of their power to ignore these critiques. But the abolitionist critique, because I think a lot to do with the internet, which democratizes our discourse, because they've had a lot of push and critique and resonance. That's really what I'm looking for there, the resonance. The large organizations, to a degree, have to acknowledge that this debate is going on. So in the 1990s, for instance, Farm, they put on their animal conference, mm-hmm. and the animal rights conference is what Farm runs, and they actually did a theme on.
So for people under, that's the Farm Animal Rights Movement, is what that acronym. That's Alex Hirschhaft's organization. But again, for people who you may be leading up to this, just that the objective of an abolitionist. And this is what I think you're alluding to.
So they technically will say, well, we want to abolish speciesism. That's the core definition of abolitionist. But what I'm saying here is that if all these organizations take on that, oh, we're abolitionists, but they're not actually in practice doing anything that would be considered conducive towards achieving an abolitionist world, that's where the abolitionist activists who are really on the radical fringe would have, you know, a critique of that.
Okay.
So it's become a very politicized word, then that's why it's very difficult for anyone to nail down. So even in my book, when I was doing a survey, even within the abolitionist faction, it's difficult to nail down a definition, because say for the folks who follow Gary Francione, they would say, well, if this group, grassroots group or organization, whatever it may be, supports or engages in single issue campaigning, that would make it not abolitionist. So for instance, protesting against fur or protesting against dairy. But then the critique is also pushed back on those hardcore abolitionists and saying, well, they advocate hardcore on veganism. So isn't that also a single issue? So you know what I mean? It's very, very contentious. And it really becomes kind of a battle over the definition and the meaning of the symbol.
It's not very specific. So if they're honing in, for their purposes, they're saying abolitionism is equatable to single issue. That's a very different kind of way to frame that versus abolition?
Well, I would say it's not just the single issue thing. So the Francionist folks would also say that if you support direct action or violence in any way. So then if you go and look at the direct action folks like the ALF, well, they would call themselves abolitionists as well. So we want to abolish exploitation of animals, so we're abolitionists. So there's also been pushback on folks like Gary Francione who try to like claim that term. You know, he's not the person who came up with that term. That term's been in use for over 100 years. In the animal rights movement, it's been in use for over 100 years. But really, Tom Reagan is the one who started to develop this concept of abolitionism in the second wave animal rights movement. So I guess the ultimate point I'm getting at here is even amongst the abolitionists, there's contention over what it means to be abolitionist.
Okay.
But if we're taking a critical look at the larger nonprofits, certainly we want to be critical of, you know, if PETA says we're abolitionists, well, I mean, we all know that PETA would like to see the end of speciesism, but PETA also engages in really weird stuff like giving awards to slaughterhouse designers or buying stock in meat companies and things like that that would, you know, maybe not sit well with a lot of activists.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum, though, where there is, I sense there's much less ambiguity, is the pure welfare. Now, I would, and I don't know what you think, but I would put, for example, an organization like HSUS or maybe the Humane League over there on the welfare side. I had both those them on recently, and they were both promoting, for example, their work on Prop 12, which was the initiative in California to go K-Tree, the exit of K-Tree. So this was, from both their perspective, this was an achievement that they were able to pass legislation in the, you know, one of the most populous states in the country that would reduce, and that's an important word, reduce the suffering of all these, I guess, millions of chickens. We achieved that goal. We achieved an incremental goal of reduction. And that's the welfare, right? Would you say that that attitude, they're more comfortable? They're okay with that sort of piecemeal approach?
Yeah, but this is what I want to really impart on folks when it comes to this debate. Because I think the tendency for us is to listen to that kind of logic and challenge it and say, that's not rational, or that's illogical, and your premises are wrong, and all that sort of thing. But in fact, it makes perfect sense when you think about what is kind of motivating this type of claims making. Because as I said a few moments ago, these folks who started these organizations, they started out quite radical. They started out wanting to end animal exploitation, or promoting abolition, or promoting veganism, or saying, like even compassion over killing animal out, whatever it is now. Sorry. But if you look at their newsletter from when they first began, in their manifesto, it said, we don't want bigger cages. We want no cages at all. Right. And then as they professionalize and get sucked into the system, then they start giving you this sort of, you know, well, you know, reducing suffering and da 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 da. Now we want, that's what we're all about. And the problem is that nonprofits, they're a business, right? They're a huge aspect of the capitalist enterprise.
I have to ask about this. So as you're talking, as the organizations become larger and mainstream, and they lose their radical edge. I spoke with, there's a couple that I spoke with that did not make that compromise. I'm thinking of, I'm going to go ahead, I'm sure they won't mind, Steve Hindy of Shark, for example. I don't know if you're familiar with that organization. Shark, Showing Animals Respect and Kindness. Steve Hindy's
I've not heard of this. So that, if okay. I've not heard of them, my guess is they're probably not a large organization.
They're very small. He's very small, but he was probably, of everyone that I spoke with, the most outspoken against all the other organizations. I mean, he was flat out angry against all the mainstream organizations. That he feels that he's out there on an island. His thing is like particularly cockfighting, rodeo. He's on the ground. He's got the drones going in the sky. He confronts them directly. It's not illegal, right? But he is a very small organization and very effective. He's able. His thing is that when the larger organizations like Humane Society or Humane League or whatever get legislation passed, they, in his word, they sort of congratulate themselves, pat themselves on the back, and move on to the next thing. Meanwhile, there's nobody on the ground to do enforcement, and so whatever the activity is that is now illegal is still going on in the shadows. So he's out there saying, no, there's enforcement, and he went really like, where do they all go? You know? So he had no compunction of being absolutely, absolutely far, you know, what I would call abolitionist. And, but his organization has remained small. There's about like five people in his entire, you know, on his quote unquote staff, and then, you know, volunteers to run the drones and things like that. But I don't think he's necessarily alone. And I think that's kind of what you're about ready to say too, is that the organizations that have remained, I don't even hesitate to use that word radical, because, you know, today's radical.
I know. Yeah. There's stigma around the term radical. Like, we should take no shame in radical, but radical, I'll clarify, radical is kind of a term used in social movement kind of rhetoric discourse in order to delineate the folks who are moderates in the middle from those who tend to have more utopian ideas or want to see society restructured. If you want a vegan world, that makes you by definition radical, even though I think we should shed that stigma about being radical.
For now, for now, you know, for now it makes you radical. You know, one of my favorite guests I had on was, Claire Mann, the dystopian society where the vision is someday it's the other way around. We're not the radicals. The radicals are the ones that are going to be, you know, slaughtering, you know, live cows and pigs. Like,
seriously,
they're the weirdos, not the ones that don't want to do that. But anyway, I digress. But so if you have what we're calling radical now, are the ones that are.
We call it moderates, and the radicals is like the terminology that's used. I like the word mainstream though, because
me too. Yeah, there you go. Okay, all right.
All right, so that's I know that was a slightly awkward place to end, but that's just part one, and you definitely want to stick around. We're gonna play the rest of this next week, and the aforementioned conversation about Trump veganism, and we're also gonna. She really gets into naming names. She really gets into some of the specifics of some of the organizations and what their shortcomings are. It's a very pointed conversation. Do check us out next week. One thing I forgot to mention in the beginning too, we were talking about Shark, Steve Indy, and he was on about a month or so ago. I received an email from him yesterday. When we had him on, he was talking about this on-again, off-again debate with a cockfighter who was defending his craft, and that debate did happen last week. I will post it. I'll post the link. It's up on his Facebook site, but I'll post it up on my website as well. Look for it later today on theotheranimals.com. It is. I'll just warn you. It's tough. It is tough to take. You're not going to have a big meal before you eat this thing, but you're just gonna shake your head and say, "You got to be kidding." So check out Steve's debate, and I'm putting the debate up in air quotes. All right. Hey, so when we come back, Tom Picard standing by. He's going to help us understand what to do when our pets start limping. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart and nice. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home, would rather be home to catch.
And we're back here on The Other Animals on WWDB, joined now by Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. Hey, Tom, I'm in the studio. Where are you?
Oh, now I'm jealous.
You're safe and you're.
I'm still quarantining, I guess.
No, you're doing the right thing. I got the urge here. What can I tell you? Hey, listen, before we get to the limping thing, I don't know if you were able to hear the first conversation there with Josh. Did I get that wrong, that whole lutein versus taurine thing? I could swear we had talked that lutein was the nutrient that cats needed. Did I?
The predominant one is taurine.
Oh, it is. All right. Well, then I will know better than, and that's the one that's virtually impossible to. Now he was mentioning that there are taurine supplements, which I don't think I'd heard of before.
I think they do make some artificial ones and all, you know, but they're also, you know, like any kind of compound, there are amino acids that are available to, like, in, you know, in medical, like pill forms and things like that for lots of things, lysine for animals who get herpes virus, all sorts of things like that are available.
Okay. All right. Now I know. All right. So tell us about limping. Now this is one of the things when you see your cat or dog limping, it is kind of scary. It's one of the more frightening things that I know. I've been through it. It's been a few years, but when you see it, it's you don't know what's going on. You know, did they step on something? Is it arthritis? It's kind of freaky. And pet owners, it's a pretty big problem. So tell us where to start with this.
It's absolutely one of the, you know, scariest for owners, you know, self included, because, you know, you don't want to see your pet be in pain. And generally speaking, if they're limping, they're in pain. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely one of the worst. It's one of the most common. Luckily, you know, knock wood, it is also one of the most not as severe, but there are obviously there's things that are severe that will cause this as well. But a vast majority of cases are similar to people. You've just basically they've just tweaked one of their joints, like a little mild sprain. That's the most common thing we see. Of course, any severity beyond that, of course, is available too. But if you think of their front legs and their back legs, they really are set up like humans are too. Their front legs have what we would call our wrist, and their back legs have ankles. You know, we just think of them differently because they're all on the ground. But it's very common that they're the equivalent of their wrist joints and their ankle joints are probably the most often sprained. The equivalent of their elbow joints and their knees are up there as well. And it's just because they running around doing something, they just take a bad step, just like we would, and they overstretch the ligaments in that joint area, and it hurts. It's a sprain. It's basically their little miniature tears in the ligaments, but as long as that's all it is, it's not something we need to do anything about other than rest. But the question is, when you see them limping, how severe is it?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing you got to look at it is like, are they completely holding their leg up or are they putting it down and just limping as they walk around? Mm-hmm. Completely holding it up can be an indication of obviously more pain, more maybe potentially more of a problem. Mm-hmm. But the first thing, if they'll let you safely look, is we check their pads. Did they step on something? Mm-hmm. Is there a cut? Is there bleeding? Mm-hmm. Is there something? Feel around carefully. Obviously, the one that they're kind of holding up or barely touching to the ground is usually the one there's the problem. But mm-hmm. check them all, even just to tell what's normal, what isn't. But carefully mm-hmm. check the one that is they're tapping to the ground or not completely holding onto the ground, because you're going to possibly find something that hurts as you reach around in there. And, you know, they might bite you just because it hurts, because they really wanted to.
So if there is the obvious, well, the first place to look is, you know, an injury of some, an obvious injury, like you say, step on something or a sprain. I'm thinking though, one of the other things that happens with limping, and tell me if I'm wrong, there are other factors like as an overweight animal, an overweight dog or cat, it seems to me is going to be more prone to having to stressing the joints around the hips and areas where there would be where they would start. Showing up where we start showing up as a limp, and the other thing is also the we tend to project, you know, from humans as when you get the elderly are always when there's a fall, it's always the hips. When the hips go, that's like really scary. That's like the beginning of the end. You know, it's like now you're in the wheelchair and everything. There are those, and there's arthritis, I guess, is a counter or a component of that. Is that in play with dogs and cats too? Those things, weight and age and arthritis and those types of things?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The ones we see have more problems are going to be the ones who are elderly and or overweight. Mm-hmm. You're putting excess, either there's been a lifetime of wear and tear on a joint. Hips obviously are one of the biggest ones for older animals and younger ones who are maybe born with bad hips. Mm-hmm. And then being overweight. And that really stresses all the joints from mm-hmm. head to toe. And we'll see muscle strains, just like with people, tendon strains as you get down to the end of the muscle, and then more into the joints, the ligaments and things like that that are in there that'll get strained. So they can be any of those areas. One of the most common spots are the hips, particularly in certain breeds, mostly dogs, cats not so much, because they generally carry less weight on them than a dog, you know, depending on the size of the dog, of course. Mm-hmm. But any of them that are significantly overweight for what they should be are straining all of these areas. Mm-hmm. So that's the number one thing. If you can get your mm-hmm. pet to be their more normal weight and not be overweight, you're doing them such a favor as they get older. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even tell you how many dogs have had to been euthanized before their time because they're just big and their hips have gone and their weight has played a role in the demise of them too soon.
Other than weight control, if you do see curing the injury that you alluded to earlier, is really rest, you know, if it's one of these other issues, a sprainer type of thing, is rest really the only thing they do, or do you ever put them in some sort of a restraint or a cast or anything like that? Or
yes, that does happen, the latter. But the number one thing we use is rest, mm-hmm. and it's very hard because as soon as a dog or a cat feels good, they don't want to rest anymore. Mm-hmm.
You can't put their hips in the cone of shame, right?
cage rest. We literally have cages that we recommend people keep around because they're not going to listen to you. They're not going to stay in bed or sit on the couch and watch TV, you know? Mm-hmm. So you literally have to put them in a cage and make them take care of themselves because they won't do it on their own.
Any medicine? Other than just for pain? Is there if there's inflammation?
Only at the advice of your vet, because the good thing about pain relievers is they relieve pain. The bad thing about them is they relieve pain, and then the animal will get up and possibly damage themselves further because they don't think about it.
Yeah, yeah. I guess
when in doubt, take them to your vet.
Absolutely.
And get them checked out.
Or have
your
vet come to you.
You don't necessarily need x-rays, but it's good to get it checked out.
All right. Good to know. All right. Hey, thanks, Tom. And I think that's about where we are for today. So I want to thank my guests, Paul Shapiro and Corey Wren. And a special shout out and thanks to my engineer, Jason Duffy. I want you to join me in wishing him the best on his upcoming wedding next weekend. Congratulations, Jason and Rachel.
Congratulations, Jason.
There you go. Hey, well, love to hear from you with your comments, ideas, suggestions. If there are topics you'd like Dr. Picard to address, please check out theotheranimals.com. Let us know. Follow me on Twitter @theotheranimals. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iRoarPod.com. Next week, we're going to continue our conversation with Corey Wren. And yeah, we're going to get to that Trump veganism thing. It's a thing. You're not going to want to miss that. Until then, find a belly to rub. Stay safe.